The head of JEA steps down amid drama over the future fate of the public utility. And there's a new deal for that development on the South Bank, the District. What does it all mean? Well, just ahead, a conversation with Jacksonville City Councilman Tommy Hazzouri as he takes your calls. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and call in now. It's your chance to connect with former mayor, state lawmaker, school board member, and now Jacksonville City Councilman Tommy Hazzouri, giving his thoughts on all of the big issues affecting this community right now and so many to talk about. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, it's a hidden epidemic in this country, child abuse and neglect. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. How the First Coast is trying to protect local kids. Plus, Culpepper will be along later in the hour with more about that exciting Masters win over the weekend. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a number of high-profile issues and controversies have roiled Jacksonville City Hall in recent weeks. In particular, the back and forth and acrimony over whether the city should sell its public utility, JEA. On Friday, the CEO of the company, Paul McElroy, stepped down as the debate continues. At the same time, some city council members are speaking out against incentives for an expensive development on the South Bank, the District. And there are other issues to talk about. The city budget, public safety, so much happening. A man who's never short for words
just out of breath.
Is here to share his thoughts about all of this and more. Former mayor, state legislator, school board member, and now city councilman, Tommy Hazzouri, battled a lot of traffic to get in here on time, and he joins us now in studio. Councilman, good to see you as always.
Thank you, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, the traffic's pretty heavy this Monday morning.
Yes, indeed. And so if you're battling the roads out there, spend a little time with us here on the show and get on the line with your questions for Tommy Hazzouri. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments as well, always on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. We'll get to all of those too. Okay. Whew, let's catch our breath. As we are all trying to do and following the dizzying pace of events at City Hall lately. You know, on Friday, all of a sudden, the CEO of JEA, Paul McElroy, resigned, and he immediately stepped away from day-to-day operations of running the utility. So more intrigue over this controversy over whether the city should sell JEA to a private company. This is such an acrimonious issue now. We've had other city council members on this program giving their thoughts about this. Garrett Dennis, Matt Schellenberg. And this morning, let's begin, Councilman Hazzouri, by asking you, where do you stand on this, and what are your thoughts about McElroy's resignation Friday?
Well, first of all, I'm opposed to the sale at this time. And I've been forthcoming on that. I didn't support the 19-member committee to expand our 5-member select committee. I didn't support the select committee. I didn't think that it was up to us to move forward on a bill that doesn't exist. In all my years in public office, and I've mentioned this at the council meetings, I've never discussed an issue that we didn't create and a bill that's not before us. It's a phantom bill. If the civic council, if the mayor, if the JEA wants to get together and propose legislation, then I think that we should then go over what they're recommending and put the caveats in there and the things that we want to do to protect the employees, the pension plans, and all of that. The other thing with McElroy, you know, he's a good man. I hate to say that maybe it's my experience. A couple of weeks ago, I told some friends, I said, you know, there's going to be a scapegoat in this thing, and it's going to probably be Paul McElroy. He's due for retirement or an extension of his contract on September the 30th. Either he's going to retire, I had no advanced knowledge. There's no way to know. I don't talk to McElroy that much except when he comes to the meetings. I don't see him that much. And I said, or he'll politely resign during the middle of the time. Someone will ask him. I don't know what happened.
Are you insinuating that maybe he was pushed?
No. Okay. I think he's frustrated. Okay. I don't think he's pushed. I think when I saw him at the last meeting I was attending in our select committee, and I do go to them, they had a break for about 10 minutes. And I could tell talking to him that he felt, he didn't say this, but being around enough to know, he felt, you know, he's got to appease, to some degree, the city council, the mayor's office. And he was caught in the middle. And even the JEA board members who were all appointed by the mayor. Mm. And I just felt probably that it was a no-win position for him. He didn't say that. I had no reason to think that, that he may step down. But the time had come. And I think what, to me, what was the final turning point on this was the project in Georgia.
Let me ask you more about that. This nuclear power plant JEA has invested in Georgia, billions of dollars over budget now, years behind schedule. This Vogtle power plant, one of McElroy's final acts was to testify about this. And we're getting emails about this, by the way, from people up in Georgia, where they want the cost recovery fee stopped. They still elect public service commissioners in Georgia. Now they're appointed here in Florida by the governor. Articles up in Georgia are calling this Vogtle plant a boondoggle. And so given that new information we have about JEA's ties to this nuclear plant, does that inform your decision, Councilman Hazzouri, to say now is not the time to sell this utility? Or would it be a good idea to sell the utility to get some of this debt cleared? Because advocates are saying that this is a way to wipe the slate clean on a lot of debt and tackle other city projects and all of that.
You know, this is such an issue that we could talk about all day. Everyone has spent whatever money they think we may be getting from $2 billion to $6 billion, if that's the case, every which way but loose. It reminds me of the lottery. Somebody very well may say, oh, I'll give 50% to my church or synagogue. You know, just give it, show me the money. It's not just about the money. It's about what's right for Jacksonville, what's right for our ratepayers. And again, we can't do all the necessary investigation in this issue with the complexity that is attained to it. I mean, it's attached to it. It's a big issue. But let's go back to what you were saying about whether you sell it. I don't think we should sell it today. I don't think we're prepared to sell it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think if the mayor, the JEA again, and even the organization that that we were able to, the DuPont Foundation, who got the program going from the University of Florida to study this issue, if we can, you know, if they can just put all those numbers and facts together, and if they want to bring something to us, either restructuring it, finding other resources, whatever they'd like to do, then they should do that. We have bigger issues to address on the council in the next over the next
do
year.
Do you think this is taking up too much oxygen?
Absolutely. It is the headline of every day. I said this 2 or 3 months ago that you're going to just do nothing but read, aggravate the and put angst among the JEA employees, the ratepayers of Jacksonville, and we're not going to be able to do anything else because this is going to dominate our headlines. Nothing's wrong right now. Cool it. Let's take down the walls that exist between the whatever's happening between some of the council members and the mayor's office, pause, go on to other issues, and let those who are responsible for bringing a JEA proposal, if there is one, to sell or not to sell or restructure or not to restructure, to the city council. Now, this other issue takes me back to those unthrilling days of yesteryear, offshore power system.
Unthrilling days of yesteryear.
Yes, when Harry Shorstein stopped it in its tracks when he was the, not state attorney, but he was the general counsel for the city of Jacksonville. We're back. I realized and recognized that the JEA thought that nuclear power was another source. And unfortunately, natural gas came aboard faster than they thought it would. And then we got ourselves caught up in a $1.2 billion debt service to them right now.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
Now, speaking of debt and investment, before we go to calls for you, Councilman Tommy Hazzouri on the show today, and it's 549-2937. The other day, we had on one of your counterparts, Councilman Matt Schellenberg.
I heard a little bit of that.
Who has been a straw. Now, he's a proponent of selling JEA, but on the other hand, he is definitely a budget hawk on the question of city investments in this huge development on the South Bank called the District The district is looking to get more than $26 million in city investment on public areas at the site, up to $56 million in property tax rebates over two decades. Schellenberg wrote a piece about that that ran in the paper saying that this is just not a good use of taxpayer money. What are your thoughts on this and whether you think this is something that you should be signing off on?
I ain't going to sign off. If I see the bill and I read what I've been hearing from the Downtown Development Authority, Andre Wallace, the head of the Downtown Development Authority, talking to Peter Rummel, talking to some of the other investors, and talking to our council auditor and seeing what's out there, I wasn't thrilled about the fact that the city at one point, we never saw this, it just was all over the city that they were going to, that the city wanted to buy the JEA's property and then turn back around and then let some other company develop, or let a company develop it. Now, you know, I'm not going to get in with Matt Schellenberg and his thoughts. I've heard him speak to this issue at some of the lunch and learns that we have about the downtown development, I mean, about the district. I think that this, it's no more, what we're doing there, or what they're proposing to do that I've seen, is no more than the middle of the road of what we do to both sides of the North and the South Bank. I think this is a big, big project. It's one that's going to bring a lot of jobs, a lot of residents to the downtown area, much like eventually that the shipyards, the Jacksonville Landing, the Lot J. You can't sit back because other cities are
So you
are
think
competing.
It's worth the investment if it pays, if it brings
Absolutely.
All that?
In the long run, and I'm not going to be here, stay here, excuse me, I'm still recovering from the traffic. I don't want to sit here and say that we're not going to dot all of our I's and cross our T's. Absolutely, we'll do that. I rely on our council auditor. I rely on the finance director. And I rely on the information that Downtown Development or the Downtown Investment Authority is going to give us. It's going to be next to the school board. Eventually, you'll see the school board get off, I think, off the waterfront. Right now, they can't afford it because nobody will pay what they need to move to another area. Mm-hmm. They inherited the riverfront. So, but I think that whole area is going to be developed. Lori Boyer, who's a council representative there, the district representative, she is very smart. She's very astute. She does her math and arithmetic, and she knows that this is a good project. It's in her district. I keep kidding her. This is her going home bill because this is her last year, but it is something that is necessary, and it's an opportunity for us. On the other side of what Matt said, keep in mind he wanted to rebid it the other day. He didn't say that wasn't necessarily the numbers were that bad or good or indifferent. He may have addressed that, but he also thinks that we should go back out and rebid it.
All right. Let's go to some calls now for City Councilman Tommy Hazzouri. Lots of calls, lots of questions. So much happening right now all across the city. It's 549-2937 to join us this Monday. Perry is out in Ponte Vedra right now. Hey, Perry, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning,
Perry. Thank you for appearing today.
Yes, sir.
I have a comment and a question, and they are unrelated. One, I had an idea about the landing and how we're trying to rejuvenate the downtown, and I didn't know if anybody ever thought about, wouldn't the landing be a nice spot for a satellite campus for one of our colleges, a business campus for JU or UNF or that kind of thing, where we could bring in students who could then become comfortable, you know, in the downtown area. And I think it'd be a generational change in behavior.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, there's already downtown campuses, Perry. JU has a downtown campus now in the SunTrust building.
UNF.
And UNF is putting one in, but not at the landing. But did you have another comment, Perry?
You had a question, you said.
My question was, how much revenue does JEA bring into Jacksonville on a yearly basis?
Right now, we're at about $116 million in lieu of taxes. It's a in lieu of a franchise fee. Plus, there's some other dollars that we get from various other fees that total around 200. Excuse me, maybe close to I don't want to give you the number.
Over 200 million.
Over 200
a year.
Million. I said 116,000.
Right.
116 million. It'll take us over 200 million. And but the thing that you want to look at, what we will be getting, and as we continue to move on, and it increases a little bit every year. If it'll stop, if it stops, it'll be stopping because the JEA can't move forward and generate the dollars that they have been generating. But keep in mind, we get that 116 million plus all the other things that they do in the community. They contribute a lot of different dollars to very, very good organizations and projects to help bring businesses incentives to Jacksonville, to bring companies to Jacksonville. For example, I look at the Navy. I think you look at the school board and other big, maybe Amazon, I don't know where they are with Amazon that's here, but they give a discount to attract. That's one of the things that we use in our competition with other cities, a discount for the electricity. Let me go back, if you don't mind, to and they may very well get some dollars from a company. I don't want to go that far with Florida Power and Light or Duke Energy or any of the others will do. I mean, they're not home-owned. They're not home-operated. We know what's happened to all those old companies that were Steadfast here in Jacksonville from the day I was born and are gone now. And we don't get that kind of revenue like we have. We don't get that kind of community involvement. We get a lot. There's others that can be doing it. But let me just go back to one thing that you said about the education. Not necessarily at the landing. That's the iconic property of downtown Jacksonville. If I had my choice today, that would be the first thing I'd be doing is working out something finally, one way or the other, with Mr. Slayman and with the mayor to sit down and come forth and move that landing forward. That is an eyesore to the city. It is our own Ward 3, and I've talked to Tony about that. I love the family. Eli Slayman and his wife have been dedicated citizens and builders and construction, and Tony and his family has done the same thing. It can be a legacy for him, but he needs to get those warts and those.
What was his response to you?
And his, I can't really get into details with him because he's got a suit going on with the city. And the city has a lawsuit going on with him.
No, and lots of bad blood there.
I was doing that as blood.
Okay.
His heritage. But I grew up with Tony and I know him and he understands and he wants to do something. I know the mayor does, but sometimes.
Then who do you hold accountable ultimately for that? Because it's, as you pointed out, this has been a long-running issue.
Right now, I don't want to, I'm not the mayor, obviously, and I'm not going to go out there and say this is what I want done. You know, eminent domain is something that could take place.
You think
if we
the
had
city
a public
should take it?
The bottom line, I think we should if we can't hammer out a difference. I want to see, that is the focal point of downtown Jacksonville. You watch it on national news, on television, whatever, but you can sit up there and look at the river and look at the landing from a distance and it looks beautiful. You go up to it and you see like digital TV. You see all the warts and moles and everything else that's on the face of the landing.
So you think if the litigation keeps dragging on with no resolution, the city should enact an eminent domain, take over the Jacksonville landing.
You have to have a public purpose, and it has to be for specific things, and that's what we have to have in mind when we do that, Melissa. The thing is I don't know what the lawyer, I don't want to get into the legal aspects of it, whether we can do that, or I hope I'm not speaking out of turn for it, but I think both Tony and the Slayman family and the mayor and the administration should sit down and really not leave the room until something is resolved. Let me just quickly go back to what Perry said about downtown and education, having kids downtown. I am 150, 60, 70, 80% for what you're saying. Not necessarily at the landing, but to bring kids, to have a big educational opportunity downtown. UNF has it. JU has it. They're expanding in the new old Barnett Bank building and the Laura Street Trio. They've got two floors now, and they may very well, the UNF may very well expand that. But to have a college campus downtown or have kids from all of our college campuses downtown brings young people with expendable income and wanting to live downtown. And
that's,
I think,
a good
the same
thing
is true for medical. I think we
medical
have such a
tourism.
Big medical complex to bring medical entities to downtown Jacksonville with young people. The young people the millennials will spend the money and they will come, but you've got to give them some entertainment and retail to make that happen.
Let's go to Rick on the west side now. Rick, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to kind of speak out in general against corporate welfare. I want to point out at Riverside, I believe I'm correct on this, but at the last minute, the public's contribution to that process was greatly increased, and the private contribution was greatly decreased. I think Jacksonville for many years has been guilty of giving out corporate welfare. It seems they can never get back what is promised to them. And I think it's gotten to the point where we have to assume that that is the process. The money will be transferred, you know, from the public to the private. The development that's coming up, I suspect a lot of the subsidies will go to subsidize the price of high-end condominiums. For example, bringing the price of a condominium down from $250,000 to $220,000, as has been done in many times in the past. I want to challenge Mr. Hazzuri to tell us what he will do to make sure that that big investment is not corporate welfare and is indeed a private-public partnership.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
Thank you. It's not a challenge to me. I've seen successes and I've seen failures, not necessarily while I was in office, but nonetheless, they affect me as a taxpayer and as a citizen. But I've also seen many, many successes. You know, we have to compete to bring jobs here, to bring more people here, to build our city, to build our tax base, expand our tax base. We are in competition with the Austin, Texases, the Charlottes, the Savannahs, the Atlantas, all of these, Miami and Tampa. Tampa, look at Tampa as a prime example of how they've turned downtown Jacksonville, downtown Tampa, completely around under the mayor. And he's getting ready to leave, but that Riverfront Park, I think they call it down there.
And that was a P3, right? Public-private partnership.
Exactly. Let me tell you, the difference in what they're doing at the district, I'm not saying different in prices, is where we've been doing it individually, and we continue to do that for individual projects. We're doing the whole district for this particular project. So everything that we've done for individual construction of a condominium or whatever it might be, a business or whatever it might be, For the district, it's the whole area. It's the whole tax. I call it a tax increment district, a CRA. And each individual item that is built there, whether it's retail or not. And, you know, keep in mind, we're going to have 4 acres of park space, docking facilities, a bulkhead there.
They want to extend the Riverwalk,
yes,
right?
Extension of the Riverwalk, kayaking.
You're saying there's some public benefit.
Absolutely. And the big benefit is going to be the jobs it's going to produce, the taxes it's going to create, and other developments that will occur around there.
Is it worth that much? I think that's what his
is it worth
point
that much?
Was, is that corporate welfare if the city kicks in
I don't
that
like
much?
The word
you don't like
corporate
that term.
Welfare. That may be a nice Republican term or a Democratic term, and they would say, somebody would say, well, you're a Democrat, it's corporate. Corporate welfare to me is not attributable to any of these projects. We're taking a bet, and we're doing it keeping the taxpayers in mind. And I do believe that Lenny Curry, as a CPA, that's his first thing that he says. And here, you know, this is a Democrat talking about a Republican mayor. I think he's very conscious. I'm not going to say he's perfect about what he's doing with his numbers, but we have our own council auditor, and we're not going to make a decision where we don't see that we're not going to lose money. If we see that we're going to lose money, we're not. We can't project what may happen. Let me tell you, we're at the apex of development right now. The reason that some of these projects failed that they started out with a few years back that failed or we lost money on is because of the recession. So we're right now at the time that the best deal that you can have is going to happen at this moment, because you don't know whether there's going to be a recession on board and whether these people aren't going to, and they're not going to be able to build those things that they said that they would build, so people will come. So this is what you have to do. You have to take a chance, but we're not going to give away the store. We want to sell Jacksonville.
Let's go to Ruth now in South Shores. Hey, Ruth, how are things your way? Good morning.
I live in South Shores. I've lived here 25 years, and I am literally probably a new resident compared to others that have been born here and lived here for many, many years. We are very, very concerned over here regarding the fact that the district, of course, seems to be on slate to be built. And FEMA has come in along with Lori Boyer at a meeting and offered to buy a number of houses that were flooded. We want to know about several things about the land poisoning. We think that the land has still not been mitigated where the district is going to be built. Is that true? That's one question.
Yeah, let's talk about, okay, so that's one question you have, and then the other question had to do with how the city is preparing for God forbid we have more historic flooding. And South Shores is a South Bank neighborhood, isn't it?
That's correct. Exactly.
Yeah, that's near St. Nicholas.
It is on the west side of Bishop Kenny. It's the only property that we're aware of that FEMA has come in and made an offer to buy homes that were flooded, even though there were many properties flooded in San Marco as well as St. Nicholas proper. We're the neighborhood in between. It's a smallish neighborhood.
Yeah.
We are very, very concerned that the future plans are really not being revealed to us and that they really want to take over our property.
Huh.
And eventually, yeah, we're really scared to death. And I've been talking to many people that have lived here decades, many decades.
I'm going to put you back on hold. Give the call screener your number, Ruth, so we can contact you later.
And your address, too,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, please do that. Now, okay, 2 points from her. One, these folks on the South Bank near St. Nicholas and South Shores feel like they're not getting enough information. They're worried about someone maybe taking their homes. That may or may not be a legitimate worry. And then two, she mentioned the city response to flooding. I'm getting emails about that for you too. Pointing out, a listener writes, no one in government kept track of the degree or the locations of Irma's flooding in the downtown areas. So city planners don't even have serious data to work from to prepare for another event like that. Okay, so 2 points there from Ruth.
You're very technical. And both of those questions that you raised, I'm going to, I'm not going to talk to Lori because I can't talk about something we may end up voting on, but I'm going to take your name and your number, your address and number, and get with Public Works and get an update. And then I know Lori has been on top of this. I don't know as much about this particular issue as what I've been reading. And when I see Lori in front of something like this, I know that she's going to follow through. And she doesn't want her neighborhood flooded. She doesn't want anybody's neighborhood flooded, northwest, east, or south of Jacksonville, the beaches included. And as far as the flooding plan, we had a problem, I think, again, and it wasn't the city as much as the state, I believe, with the Calford restaurant. And it took a little while to get that going. And it's still an issue over there. And I don't want to dance around your question because I don't know. I'll up front. I don't know the answers, but I know that they are working on a flood plan to enhance the flood plan that we have. It's never enough. You have 18 inches of rain. I don't care what city you're in. You're going to be flooded. To what extent it's going to continue to go on in Jacksonville and to how we can reduce that flooding and minimize it is what we're going to be working on. And I'll get those answers for you. John Pappas in Public Works will help me with that. And he'll get me an update on it. And I'll let him talk to Lori and give her your number as well.
Yeah, and we'll make sure everyone connects. Okay, Ben is in Fruit Cove. Hi, Ben. Good morning.
Good morning. My question has to do with the development on the south side and in the development order as it ultimately ends up being presented. I hear a lot of nice words about access. And for those of us with the economic wherewithal, either have boats or be fortunate enough to live on the river, another nice promenade is good. But what about those citizens that don't have those economic assets? What about the ones that live close to downtown? What about access to that public resource known as the river? Can we not put something in there to allow those people to actually be able to go and use that section of the river for fishing?
Absolutely.
Because that is something, if you look around, that people are doing it. And I know that it can be untidy.
Sure. No, we get you, Ben. Okay. Yeah, access to the river. Thank you for that.
And that is something, seems like this is the Lori Boyer hour. She is taking the river on her own with the Waterways Committee.
That is her big thing.
It is. Yeah. And as she leaves, she wants someone to take it over. And I'd be the first one to volunteer. We're going to extend the river walk. We're going to have access to the river. I don't want to sound like President Trump. It's going to be great, but it will be. We're going to have access. We're going to end up connecting the McCoy's Creek with Hogan's Creek.
You're going to make the river access great
the
again.
The river is going to be access for the disabled. We're going to have kayaks. And we're going to have and it's going to be accessible to everybody, whether you're down there at the district. And that's not, let me mention that, that's not just a, you called it something a while ago. It is truly a mini city with the apartments that they're going to, the condos they'll have there, the retail that they'll have there, the access to the river. And we're redoing and rerouting actually, we're rerouting the road on Prudential Drive
now,
for accessibility that we did when I was on the school board.
Can that road handle that? I mean, that's a lot of extra traffic coming in and out of there.
Right now, you know, look at the school board. You've got, you know, hundreds of cars in parking.
You're going to have hundreds more.
But they close at night. And so you do have access to the retail and all in the evening. Plus, they're getting an additional 100 places. And they'll continue to look at more parking. I hope less garages, but that may be where – keep in mind where we're coming from. Mike Belanke, who has built around Jackson, was the one who's talking about the gondolas that go across the river. He has got a plan now to develop it right in front of the district, well, on Kings Road, a 32-story condominium or apartment complex that's soon going to happen. There's some legislation involved in that or lawsuits.
Okay, right? And let's take one more call for Tommy Hazuri. It's Willie on the north side. Hi, Willie. Go ahead.
Hi, Tommy. This is Frank Lyons. How are you this morning?
Hey, Chief. How you doing? Chief, and that's not just calling him Chief. He was my fire. He's one of my fire chiefs back in the day.
Oh, very nice. Go ahead.
Tommy, I wanted to ask you, why do we continue to look inside the JEA for a multi-million dollar director when you had Royce Lyles, and also you had another director? Why do we look inside for a person to run a multi-million dollar organization when most other companies go outside and look for a well-rounded administrator?
Okay, thanks for that question.
Well, Frank, you came from the JEA, but let me say this. You know, in the past, we used to always say we needed an engineer to run the JEA. What you need as a head is a well-rounded, as you indicated, not necessarily an engineer. And when I was in the legislature, we changed the law that it didn't have to be an engineer because Royce Lyles had been an inside person there. And I kind of felt that they would look at him as being one that they would appoint, and they did. And he did a marvelous job, really, for the JEA. He was one of the best directors. You were talking about Bucells. I don't know. You know, I questioned that myself. And McElroy, and before him, I can't recall his name, another one. It was just before McElroy. Mm-hmm. We want the best. And if it's inside or outside, now I don't know if the interim director is going to apply. I don't know how they're going to do that. I'm certain that they'll do a national search. And then I think that they're going to have to get a well-rounded, a person who knows the industry and who knows every aspect of the industry. And I think that that's what they're going to do. Wouldn't you want to have somebody local if you possibly can, if they're qualified? I mean, I don't want to prevent them from qualifying for or trying to get a job here as the head of the JEA if they have the credentials that somebody else in Utah may have. But I think it should be open. The thing I want to make sure of that is indeed open, I don't want to see what just occurred in some other areas that happened in Jacksonville when they select someone for a particular
You're talking about the Kids Hope Alliance.
Yes,
we
exactly.
Didn't even get into that.
No.
Well, you'll have to come back another time because there's just too much to even fit into the segment.
Frank, you did a great job. He is a small businessman on the north side who opened up a cafe, and he has been successful. And he's in, what's the name of the...
He's gone.
But anyway, facility over there on Moncrief, and it's done a great job.
Good for him.
And yes, and that's what we want to do, not just at the district. We want it all over Jacksonville. And, you know, it takes a vision. If you can be one city, one Jacksonville, then you've got to be inclusive. That's why I supported the HRO. That's a big deal for me because it's a big deal for this city to open up the city to other opportunities for everyone.
Always great to have you on the show. Come back soon. And
Thank you. Thanks
for battling the traffic to get here today.
Thanks, Melissa. I'm still recovering. Thanks a lot.
Tommy Hazuri with us, and much more still ahead later. Culpepper will stop by, all about the new winner up at the Masters. Did you watch over the weekend? But up next, battling child abuse and neglect on the First Coast, the work of Daniel Kids in a moment. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. The Move Over Law protects police, fire, EMS, utility, and sanitation personnel and requires drivers to move over and slow down when approaching their vehicles. More at waynehogan.law.
Hi, I'm David Luckin. There are many reasons to give to WJCT, but the most important is that you value the programming on the station and want to sustain it. Our spring pledge drive begins Saturday, and you can get a head start by becoming a sustainer today by calling 1-800-722-9528 or pledge online today at WJCT.org.
The ability of technology to manipulate and alter reality is growing at a breakneck speed.
Will technology blind us to the difference between what is real and what is fake news?
That's terrifying.
Is what I'm seeing true?
Oh, God.
Is what I'm hearing real? How do you have a democracy where people can't trust anything that they see or read?
Breaking news on the next Radio Lab.
Sunday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive into the Blues Horizon this weekend. As you're coming home from the Spring and the Blues Festival, the festival continues on your radio with a special Blues Horizon two-night event. This Friday and Saturday night at 9, the artists you know and the artists you should know on 89.9 WJCT. Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues. Our annual spring special, this Friday and Saturday night at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a hidden epidemic in this country. Children who suffer from abuse and neglect. Nearly 700,000 U.S. kids are abused each year, according to the National Children's Alliance. Now, here in our area, the Department of Children and Families reports more than 19,000 suspected cases of maltreatment were logged last year in Duval County alone. Put that in perspective, that's about two reports every hour of every day. Abuse can come in many forms, whether it's from neglect or emotional, physical, or sexual abuse. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and right now we're pleased to welcome the new CEO of Daniel Kids, Leslie Wells. She's here now with more about efforts to protect local children from abuse and neglect. Good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations, you are the newly minted CEO of Daniel after working there for, 30 years?
Yes, that's correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm very fortunate to lead this wonderful organization and very excited.
Yes, and of course, Daniel, I think, is one of the oldest nonprofits in the area working with children. And this is a timely topic. Not only is April Child Abuse Prevention Month, there was this case, actually not in our area, but out on the West Coast, that made headlines just the other day. These parents that drove their car off a cliff with their adopted kids inside, and they all died. And then after that happened, reports started coming out that neighbors had been concerned that the kids were being abused. They tried to get child welfare authorities to follow up, but they did not reach those children in time. Those types of stories just make people enraged and so sorrowful. And there are so many other stories like that out there. And that, of course, is what you're focused on, is trying to protect kids in those vulnerable situations. So with April being the month of awareness for this, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing here in our area and what the big issues are here.
Well, as you mentioned, there were 19,000 calls locally to the abuse hotline. And out of that, over 2,000 were confirmed cases of abuse. So that's about 5 cases per day of child abuse and neglect. Probably one of the greatest misconceptions is that neglect is actually the number one form of abuse, which is defined as a failure to provide needed age-appropriate care such as shelter, food, clothing, education. And most substantiated child abuse cases, even here locally, are about 3 years, with infants being the most vulnerable.
So if neglect is so much more common, I would think that's a harder form of abuse to track and document, too.
It is. There are the warning signs that we can educate ourselves, which is why April is dedicated to child abuse and prevention. The warning signs that we can look for is children asking for food, Children that mm-hmm. are having poor hygiene and frequently missing school. Aggressive behavior towards not only adults, but children and pets. Mm-hmm. Wearing ill-fitting clothing or inappropriate clothing, possibly to be covering injuries.
These are all signs that if you see a child exhibiting any of these, you need to follow up. People are often afraid to get involved.
Correct.
They worry, well, what if I'm falsely accusing the parents? What do you advise people to do if they're worried that maybe a child in their neighborhood, their school, their church, whatever, that there's something wrong?
You know, Daniel, and if you suspect that a child is being abused, do not be a bystander. Make the call. Make the call to the 1-800-96-ABUSE. It's the Florida Abuse Hotline. It's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Your call remains confidential. It's better to err on the side of the caution for the child and the family's sake.
1-800-96-ABUSE. That's the Florida Abuse Hotline, a 24/7 hotline. As you said, Leslie, it's confidential. So if you see any signs of abuse in a child or neglect, call that number and report it. And then a lot of these children find their way to Daniel Kids. It's the oldest child serving agency in the state.
Correct.
Actually, not just Jacksonville, but the state.
Yes, Melissa. And as you mentioned, we have been providing services for over 133 years. We probably are best known for our residential treatment center, which serves children 5 to 17 years of age. Mm-hmm. Some of the most children with the mental health and emotional needs here on the Duval County. And a lot of those children that we see are victims of child abuse mm-hmm. and are experiencing the trauma that they went through.
Yes, and you also work on adoption and foster care placement for children.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. We provide adoption and foster care services that really help connect abused and abandoned children with safe and loving homes. And when possible, our ultimate goal with foster care is to solve the underlying issues that the family and to try to reunite those children with their families.
And what's the track record on family reunification in this area? Because there are a lot of people working on that. The court system, Daniel, as you said, other nonprofits. DCF?
It is always the goal for us to strengthen the family and try to get that family back healthy that they can take their children back.
Yeah.
And if that's not a possibility, is to try to find permanency through family members that will agree to take those children in and provide a loving and safe environment or through adoption.
Right. With all of that said, for people that are listening and they'd like to help, there's an easy way to do that. Daniel Kids has a big event coming up, and it's a fun fundraiser. It's the Jacksonville Backyard Barbecue Championships. That's coming up on April 14th, this weekend.
Yes, we are very excited. That's this Saturday at Tailgaters Parking, and it is a fundraiser to provide scholarships through the Glenn Cook Memorial Scholarship Fund. And we provide those scholarships to children in our Independent Living Project Repair Program who are struggling and going back to college and going back to secondary education, and try to give them some dollars and to assist them on their ways.
Right. So come on out this Saturday from noon to 5 to Tailgaters. They're right in the shadow of the football stadium. Have some barbecue. Have some fun. It all benefits Daniel Kids, the oldest child welfare agency in Florida, based right here in town. Just go to danielkids.org, danielkids.org for more. New CEO Leslie Wells, shattering the glass ceiling like so many other great women in this community. Congrats on the new position, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back with Culpepper and the Masters.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. It's the number one killer of teens. One text or call can wreck it all. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving. More from board-certified civil trial lawyer Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air...
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Terry talks about Rodgers and Hammerstein with Todd Purdom. His new book explores the creative partnership that transformed musical theater. He'll talk about shows that didn't work and the stories behind their great successes. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
A panel of scholars and community leaders will be traveling to North Carolina to discuss the historic town of Eatonville, Florida at the Black Communities Conference. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will discuss historic preservation efforts in Eatonville. We'll talk about aerial photographs from 1930 and the use of buckshot in the Seminole Wars. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
For many music fans, Elvis Presley is still the king. But how did he become that way? A new documentary tracks his life and music from Memphis through world tours and his final tragic chapter with music and footage that's never been seen. Elvis Presley, The Searcher, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, slow and steady on the final round, wins the day at the Masters.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Patrick Reed wins his first major title. Cole Pepper is here with more about the tournament and the rest of the weekend sports. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, I don't think Patrick Reed, among all the storylines we talked about last week, was discussed
at all.
We had Tiger Woods coming back, Phil Mickelson hoping to become the oldest Masters champion ever, Rory McIlroy trying to win the career Grand Slam, Jordan Spieth trying to come back and continue his great play at the Masters, but it was Reed who finished tied for second at the PGA Championship last year, who won a major for the first time in his career, shot a final round 71 to finish at 15 under par for the tournament. Reed shot in the 60s the first three rounds and then held off charges by Ricky Fowler, Jordan Spieth, and John Rahm, all on the final day to take the green jacket.
To win your first majors is never going to be easy, and it definitely wasn't easy today. I mean, I knew it was going to be a dogfight, and you know, it's just a way of God basically saying that let's see if you have it. Everyone knows you have it physically, you know, with the talent, but do you have it mentally? Can you handle those ups and downs throughout the round?
And that's really was the thing, that the ups and downs that other people didn't handle as well, or maybe they were too far back. Spieth shot a final round 64, nearly historic.
Yeah.
The only blemish on his card, a bogey in the final hole. Even still, if he pars that hole, still, it is a first-place finish for Patrick Reed. Reed did have some familiarity with the region. He won a pair of college national championships while playing golf at Augusta State. Now 27 years old, he wears the green jacket as the Masters champion. So there is the first major of the year. Now we'll start to turn our attention to the Players' Championship in a month. Tiger Woods has still not committed there. Tiger, by the way, did say after his final round yesterday he's going to get back into the gym before he started making decisions
so
on his schedule.
So he may be out at Sawgrass in May.
I think everybody's hoping he'll be out there for sure.
That'll add some excitement, won't it?
It will, as will having, you know, the feel that they always have, and a lot of storylines of that. We'll talk about that as we get a little closer.
All right. Also over the weekend, lots of excitement as the U.S. Women's National Team won in Jacksonville on Thursday over Mexico.
Yeah, and then beat Mexico in Houston yesterday 6-2. By the way, rave reviews from head coach Jill Ellis and the players about their experience playing here in Jacksonville.
I think this field is one of the best fields we've ever played on, and the grass is perfect. And so for us, it was a perfect night to play some good soccer and had a great crowd here in Jacksonville.
It was great. You know, I think the fans were exciting. The American Outlaws were pretty loud, and I think we gave the fans a really good game, and it just felt really fun to be playing out there, and the field was perfect.
The pitch was unbelievable. You know, it was a great stadium with the Jumbotrons as well, and so it was really enjoyable to be here.
Yeah, those were three of the top American stars, including Carly Lloyd, who you heard there at the end, who scored her 100th career goal for the U.S. yesterday. I will say that every time U.S. soccer, whether it's the men's national team, the women's national team, comes there, rave reviews for the facilities
they
for Jacksonville.
It.
And Jacksonville's really become one of those cities in the rotation for U.S. soccer. They really enjoy coming here. And I will also say, being out in the parking lot before the match, seeing the number of girls in soccer jerseys, either U.S. soccer jerseys or their club teams or Armada shirts, what have you, who are so excited to be able to go in there.
That's fantastic.
Out of the 14,000 and change who were there, I'm going to guess maybe a third of them were girls who played soccer, or at least families with girls who played soccer. And great to, for them to be able to see the number one ranked team in the world.
You can't see.
Yeah.
So then they have a role model, a successful professional athlete they can be looking at.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Including Morgan Bryan, who's from St. Simon's Island and played her club soccer here locally, to see her out there playing for the U.S. I think a very inspirational thing. And who knows, maybe one of those girls who was at Everbank Field on Thursday may, in 5 or 10 or 15 years, pull on the shield for the United States.
That'd be exciting. That's a great anecdote from that, Cole. Okay. Last but not least, Cole says a busy week this week for home openers in the sports complex, the Jumbo Shrimp and the Sharks.
Yeah, interesting note on the Jumbo Shrimp, by the way, who open the home portion of their schedule on Wednesday. Two of their coaches are from Jacksonville. Pitching coach Storm Davis and hitting coach Kevin Witt, both former major leaguers who have a rare opportunity to be coaches in the pros in their hometown. So that's going to be kind of a neat thing to follow. Talked to both of them last week about playing coaching in Jacksonville. They're both very excited about it. The Sharks open the season Saturday with a road win over the Carolina Cobras. They host the Massachusetts Pirates on Saturday at the arena in the home opener there. We should also mention that Saturday, spring games for new coaches at Florida and at Florida State. A lot of change, a lot of intrigue about what's going to happen with Dan Mullen and the Gators, and also Willie Taggart and the Seminoles.
Right.
JU will also hold their spring game on Saturday.
Stuff happening all over.
There's never a lack of stories to follow.
Never. Always a busy guy. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all your sports news and notes. Make sure to catch him every Monday morning here on our show. Thanks, as always, for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Kevin Murchard is our producer. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A's up next with the spotlight on the voice of all of those beloved Muppet characters, Frank Oz. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, stay tuned for music. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. See you then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.